Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk. And this week's guest is Elizabeth Bozovich. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be talking to you two.
Yeah, glad to have you with us. And of course, for those who don't know, Elizabeth is the editor, publisher, owner, and everything else of Needlepoint Now magazine. And if you're not reading Needlepoint Now magazine, you're just frankly missing out. So there you have it.
thank you.
And Elizabeth,
I do have a staff though, Gary. I don't do it all by myself.
Oh, a staff.
Yeah.
Good for you. Good for you. What's that like to have a staff and do a magazine? I wonder.
It's the hardest part of the magazine.
Yep. And just for the record, getting Elizabeth pinned down in one place long enough to do one of these things is a struggle. You need to stay home more often, really.
I would like that. But if I don't get out there, I don't know what people want.
Yes.
Good point.
Yep. So as a magazine editor, I got to know, I mean, tell the story. How did you end up with Needlepoint Now? Because you did not start it, right?
No, I didn't. Joyce Lukomsky started it, and she was the editor of the American Needlepoint Guild's magazine, Needlepointers, and she was let go after 17 years. And some of her friends encouraged her to start another magazine. And she started Needlepoint Now in 1999. And I bought it from her in 2009 when she was ready to retire.
So you've had it 8 years?
Yeah, I'm in my eighth year.
Yeah. Wow. So you got it. I'm assuming it's, I haven't been reading it that long. I'm assuming that it's quite different from when you first got it.
Well, my skill set was different from Joyce's. She has like more of a writing, she's a very poetic person. And those were her skills. And my skills were graphic design. And I was a stitcher and she was a needlepoint teacher.
Oh. Very different then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Different approach. Yep.
Different approach.
So you bought it go ahead, Christine.
No, I was going to say, so do you find that the types of articles that you gravitated towards writing were different, or that not so much writing, but soliciting were different
Definitely.
Than it used to be? Yeah.
Definitely. For one thing, I was not a known entity, and I didn't have a stable of friends that were designers that I could call on to contribute articles. So my approach to getting content for the magazine was a little different than Joyce's. I pay for content. I'll either trade an ad or I have a fee that I'll pay people. And I had to make sure the magazine was pretty enough that people wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. So you buy this thing and it's just you initially?
It was just me initially. The first month, I got my husband to help me stuff envelopes. I was trying to run the office, do ads, do layout, everything by myself. And while I was trying to hire people, because Joyce and I talked about me taking the magazine for about 7 years. It was supposed to happen a lot sooner than it did. And when it did happen, it was like, okay, here's the magazine, go. And I was like, oh my gosh,
no runway for that at all.
No. So at first it was a little dicey. But I was able to find people. I live in an area where there's a university that has a journalism school. I had experience with writers from other magazines that I'd worked on. And so I called on them. Hiring an office manager was tough because I had no experience with people with that skill set. So, but it all came together. I think probably our first year, I was scared all the time.
A year of fear.
It took me a year to kind of realize I'm succeeding. I'm doing it. I don't have to be afraid anymore. Now I can just be overwhelmed.
That sounds about right.
That's yeah. Right.
It's not different from the podcast, actually. You spend the first year or so thinking, you know, I can't imagine anyone would listen to this. And then the second year going, I can't believe people are listening to this. And then after that, you get used to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you bought it, what was your subscriber base? Was it the 10,000 you have now? Or I assume it's grown over the years.
I was told it was 10,000, but it was more like 5,000.
Yeah.
And we spiked. Well, we kind of grew slowly at first, and then we had a big spike. It was like people kind of wanted to watch me and see if I could really pull it off.
That's kind of a big investment
for a magazine. It's $42 a year in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like a $20 subscription to Times or something. So.
Let's see if she can pull it off.
Yeah.
I'm not buying my subscription until I see her put out three of them.
That's right. I really think that was what was going on.
That sounds logical. No, I think you're right. I think that is what people do. They want to see if something is going to stick. Because in podcasts, it's exactly the same thing. You know, people are... They want something that they can do or listen to or read again and again, not just something that's a flash in the pan, because you know, you see something, you like it, you get excited, and then it disappears again. You know, it's like watching a television show and having two episodes and there's nothing left and you get all hooked and excited and then you have no follow through, right? So that does make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. And, you know, 1 out of 5 magazines fail.
Right.
So. I'm surprised it's not higher. Quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, it might be now. That's a figure that I got when I started the magazine. Mm-hmm. It wasn't encouraging.
These days, very few magazines even get started. It's such a tough business.
It is a tough business. But, you know, I think for the needlepoint industry, they need a magazine. They need a printed piece.
Oh, the yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, that's why I enjoy it. I get the needle pointers too, but yours is more of a true magazine. And it's the only print magazine I subscribe to. Everything else I do the digital versions. And
yeah, we keep being asked to do digital, and we're just not quite ready to go there. And I think part of it is because I wouldn't enjoy it in a digital format. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to get past that I need to hold the magazine. I like to write in it as I'm working on the projects. And I can't stand being connected to a computer in my leisure
time. All the time. Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's the thing. I sit down in the recliner and read that. Yes. Yeah. Some topics just have to have paper. You just have to.
I agree.
Yeah. And with the projects you have in there, having those on printed and in your hand, you know, that helps. I mean, it really helps. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it does help.
Yeah.
So I think what we're going to do, we've been talking about this for a couple of years. We have some sold out issues, but people still request the projects. I think we're going to eventually offer them in a digital format.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, that's one of the good things and bad things about the kind of content you have is, those projects. I've got one that I wanted to do that was spread over 3 issues, and I traveled a lot too. And it took me, half dozen or 8 trips going in the evenings to needlepoint stores before I was able to locate all 3 of them.
You should have called us.
that would be logical and make sense. then that didn't give me an excuse to go hunting down needlepoint stores either.
That's true. I mean, I look for any excuse I can to go into a needlepoint store. Oh my gosh, I broke a needle. I should go to a needlepoint shop. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because I found the third one in Las Vegas. And I mean, I'm in Vegas all the time. I do not like the city. And so I found a needlepoint shop there, and by golly, they had the third one I needed for the set, and so I was happy. Yeah.
Yeah, they have a nice needlepoint shop there, actually.
Yeah, the one on Paradise?
That's the one I know.
Yeah, that's the one I know. I think there's 2 of them, but that's the one I know, and yeah, I really like it, yeah. Of course, for me as a male walking into needlepoint shops, you know, the first look is he here to rob the place or lock us in the back?
Where's his wife?
Yeah.
Yeah, because Gary is a very, very threatening and intimidating looking individual.
I can tell by his photo.
Right?
Yeah. You know, my father-in-law did needlepoint, and he was a psychiatrist, and he would do needlepoint while seeing his patients, and
really?
It helped them relax. Because there wasn't the eye-to-eye contact that makes a lot of people nervous.
Mm.
So,
well, that's
a lot of men.
That's neat.
Yeah.
So you're not alone, Gary.
No.
No, we have a lot of male subscribers.
Yeah, I'm learning more and more, especially as we do this podcast. And then it wasn't too long ago that I located Needlepoint Nation, and I'm discovering that there are a lot more men.
There's a lot
doing
of talented
it.
Men out there.
Yeah.
I'm writing a story about a man that lives in Washington right now. He does three-dimensional needlepoint houses. He's from the UK originally, and he's reproducing the village he grew up in.
Oh,
no.
Wow.
Oh. We got to get him.
See, yeah, and I think that, so the thing is, though, it's with like with any hobby that is predominantly either men or women oriented, it's a matter of the people who are the minority getting out and being the example, because you just have one or two people that are there as the beacons that, yes, in fact, we are here. And then all of a sudden, everybody starts coming out of the woodwork. So you just need that one or two to sort of break the ice. So,
right.
Gary, that's exactly what you should be doing.
You should if you right. Google celebrities that do handwork, you'll come up with what's Arquette? I can't remember his first name, but
is it David?
Yeah, he knits. And there's a lot of celebrities that stitch. So I'm always trying to contact him, and I haven't figured out how to do that yet.
See, I would think, you know, especially if you're, well, any movie or TV person, a lot of downtime with that. I would
right.
quickly find something to do, like stitching or knitting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, sitting because that's, I mean, from what I can tell, reading what little I read about that world, those people spend a lot more hours sitting and waiting right. than they do actually acting. So
yeah, almost as much time as we do in airports, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And I think we need to figure out a way to make needlework acceptable in business meetings. So I sit all the time trying to figure out how I can manage to do that, because it would make those meetings a lot more enjoyable, because, you know, when you get frustrated or you get bored or any of those things, you're doing something. And for me, I find that it helps me think better, because if you're occupying a portion of your brain, the rest of your brain can work a little bit better on the other thing that you need to do. I don't know if
there's scientific research on that knitting or needlepoint while listening to a lecture or something makes you somehow engage your brain so that you retain more of the information.
Yes. Okay. So I'm not completely crazy. So that's
no,
encouraging.
It's true.
So perhaps I can find that study and bring it in and justify then my sitting in meetings.
I read about it in one of the knitting magazines. So I'm sure we can find it on Google.
Yes. We need to do that, because I think it does actually, it serve quite a bit of purpose, you know, not only just, you know, passing time, but, you know, affecting mood, affecting concentration. I think people have the idea that if you're doing needlework, you're not paying attention to anything else. And for me, I think it's usually quite the opposite. It allows you to focus better on the other thing that you're doing.
Right.
Because it sort of distracts that little bit of monkey mind you have going on that's thinking about, you know, what's for dinner? Right. Yeah. You know, is my kid, you know, did he get home from school? Like all the other ways that your mind would be traveling now is occupied with the needlework, and the rest of it is on your office work. And so you're actually more functional, I think. Anyway, how's that?
I think you're right. And I just wrote an article about how the health benefits of needlepoint, that people that have high blood pressure or a lot of stress in their lives, that needlepoint or doing something like needlepoint can help lower your stress levels, make you relax, bring your heart rate down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, yeah, I mean, that's,
yeah,
I don't need research for that, I'll tell you. Yeah. I just need a half hour at the stand with a thread and I'm good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does make a difference. It really does. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think sometimes it depends the type of project you take on. Like, there are times where you want something that's complex and challenging that you really have to focus on and pay attention, like a counted piece or something like that. And then there's other times where you want something that is just completely mindless, where it becomes almost a meditative activity, where
like
there's
zen-like.
Correct. Right, exactly. Where you're, you know, for knitting, if you're just going back and forth in a single stitch and you're just waiting until you count up enough inches of a particular, you know, area of a project, or I imagine in needlework, you know, going through filling in background area, sometimes that, you know, depending on the mood you're in and what your needs are at the time, that activity where it is truly mindless is so incredibly soothing and beneficial.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, see, I have
basket weave.
Yeah, and I have two kinds of, I buy two kinds of charts. I have the ones, you know, the Debbie Raleigh charts where you gotta pay attention, and then I get the other kind where it's like two stitches, and they're just slanted goblin or something, and the only thing you got to do is remember to change the thread every now and then. And
right, right.
Yeah, cause right. same thing. Yeah.
Painted?
Pardon
me? Do
you
work on painted canvas? Do you do painted canvases or do you like chart at work?
I like charted work. I learned doing painted canvases a long time ago when it was wool and basket weave. And,
right.
And I have two painted canvases downstairs right now that I'm just contemplating because I want to figure it out. Because I want to see if I can figure it out and do something creative and put some life to them without getting someone else's stitch guide.
I agree. I like figuring out my own stitches and what threads to use.
Yeah, so I just have them there,
it's the creative part of your brain that you're feeding.
Yeah.
When you do that.
So yeah, so I just look at them and it'll come to me.
Yes. Somebody told me one time that you need to live with the canvas for a while, so pin it up on the wall and look at it every day, and become one with the canvas, and the stitches and the threads will come to you. So I have a tendency to pin up canvases I need to work on and just kind of stare at them for a while until I figure out what I'm going to do.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm convinced. I think some of that is people who have bought too many painted canvases and they're trying to justify it. But I think there is something to that, because, I mean, that's literally what I do. I just look at it and, you know, what if this and what if that, and try to visualize it. And then there'll be a day when I'll put it on stretcher bars and take a run at it.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, we were supposed to start out with things we're working on, and I have to go last because I have to get Elizabeth's opinion, because I'm in a real thing here that's happened to me. So Christine, you start, then Elizabeth, then I'll be last.
So I have been on vacation a little bit this past week, so I have not been working too hot and heavy on anything. So I'm back with knitted hats, but I'm waiting for some charts to arrive in the mail. And at that point, I will be making my first foray into our local needlepoint shop and starting that. So for now, I'm still doing knitted hats.
That's good.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm sitting at where I stitch. So my stand's in front of me, and I look around, and there's probably 24 projects surrounding me. Two of them are three of them are for the magazine. One of them's an Annie Lane canvas that I'm working out a stitch guide that I can publish in the magazine. I've got another one that's a custom painted canvas of the Needlepoint Now logo that we'll make into a banner. And I'm doing an article on how to work with an artist to get a custom painted canvas that you like. And then Needlepoint Now teams up with Jeremy Hamilton in the United Kingdom, and we do needlepoint tours, and we always have a couple pieces that I teach on the tours. So I'm working on those.
So do you, everything, every project that goes in Needlepoint now, do you stitch it?
No, I try really hard not to.
Okay.
But I don't know. I think because I'll see a design and I'll have a vision for it, especially the painted canvas, because a lot of painted canvas designers do not stitch. And I'll see one of their works and I'll say, God, I can just envision stitches for that. And then I'll jump and say, do you mind if I stitch that for the magazine? And I've never had anyone say no.
I wonder why.
Okay, Gary, go for it. What are you working on?
Okay, here's my thing. So I have two projects going, Debbie Rowley's Diamond Delight 4 and Gay Ann Rogers' Lady Edith Geometric.
Wow.
They have both, I'm on my third run at Lady Edith, and then, and I'm on my, as soon as I get a new canvas, I'm on my second run with Diamond Delight 4. And I'll tell you why. It's not because I'm an inept idiot. It's because the pineapple leaves thing that, Susan Hoekstra's that I did, that I, sent to the framer was just a hair. Oh, good. A chiming clock. We have one too. I love them.
Sorry. I hope it's not too annoying.
Oh, we'll just let it ring all nine of them.
Yeah.
Or, no, for well, you, it'd be
actually,
seven of them.
It's only seven.
So, okay. So when I took it to have it framed, it was just a hair out of square. And of course that drives me nuts. And so they had to block it, which is, to me, was embarrassing. I just feel like I should turn in something that doesn't need to be blocked. So, which is probably silly, but hey, that's the way I am. So I thought, and then we talked to Curdy Biggs here a couple weeks ago, and one of her tips was with stretcher bars to buy metal angle pieces and put on them to hold them square so they don't shift on you.
Huh. That so, is which, a good tip.
Yeah. So, okay, so then I've got this piece that had to be blocked. I'm a little embarrassed by that. And then I've got these two pieces that I'm stitching. Well, when I finished the center square of the Lady Edith thing, I, you know, sat back to admire my work, and quite frankly, I'd stitched it quite well, but it was out of square. It was visibly out of square. It had leaned.
Was it on Congress cloth?
No, 18.
Hmm.
And but it had been on those stretcher bars for a year and it had been carried around on planes and stuff, so you know, understandable.
Right.
But it was clearly out of whack. So I thought, well, that's all right. I'll just pull the tacks and pull it back and square it up. No big deal. Wouldn't square up. The center's just, there's too much going on there. It simply would not square up.
So then there's, I thought, like an area that has packed threads and yeah, then some areas that are lighter.
Yeah. It was crisscrossing. Stitching. Yeah. It's crisscrossing threads and I stitch a little on the tight side. So, I mean, it just wouldn't budge. So then I thought, all right, I'm going to cut all that out. So on the road in a hotel room, I destroy a whole bunch of silk and take it all out, which, you know, makes you ill to begin with. And then I thought, well, all right, now I'll straighten the canvas out and I'll restitch it. It still wouldn't straighten out. I could not get it to straighten out. And by then I'd pretty much ruined the canvas pulling and tugging on it. So I had to get a new one. And then, but then, you know, after talking with Curdy, then, all right, I'm getting a square. You know, because I want to make sure these things are mounted square. And so I get a square and I discover that the Diamond Delight 4 was just a hair off. But, you know, and it's a big 17 by 17 piece. So, you know, across the full length of it, it was going to be off by quite a bit. So I thought, all right, I'll just straighten that out and continue stitching. Well, that wouldn't straighten out either. And finally, I just tore that all apart and ruined that canvas trying to get it to go. So I have to do that again. So anyway, it's been, you know, two or three evenings here where I've just accomplished nothing other than cutting threads and throwing away canvas. So so now I have these right angle brackets on my stretcher bars, and they're squared up perfectly. And I started on the Lady Edith one, and it's square. Trust me, it's square. So, but then when you sent the picture of you that we can use with the podcast, you were stitching whatever you were stitching. I don't know what it was. Looked like some fleur-de-lis thing. On slate,
right.
bars. And so then I immediately wanted to ask you, do you prefer those, or was it just that project? Because it looked like there was another one in the background that someone else was using as a slate bar, or slate, you know, set of slate bars.
And I was working on Spanish gold work, and so it's done on a muslin.
Okay.
And when you do English gold work or Spanish gold work, you work on a slate frame because you're not working on canvas. And that's how you can evenly stretch the fabric.
Okay, and those things make it just drum tight, right?
Right.
But not necessary for canvas. I just need to get my things squared up and...
There's a way... I have a video on our website. There's a way that you buy you buy stretcher bars that are the right size in one dimension, but an inch or two bigger in the other, and you lace the sides.
Oh, okay.
And that keeps your tension on the fabric a lot more even, and you can tighten it if it gets loose. You know how sometimes when you're traveling or you're stuffing it in a tote bag, it starts looking like a hammock instead of a needlepoint canvas?
Yep.
You can
yep.
tighten the sides really quickly and keep your canvas taut so it'll stay square.
So you're effectively doing a slate frame with stretcher bars.
Right.
Okay. All right, because it's just my personality. I've gone down this incredibly deep rabbit hole just trying to get canvas square. It's just like last night I just put it all down. I realized for three nights I hadn't stitched a thing. All I'd done is pull tacks and push them back in. Both my thumbs are sore. And it's just...
Oh, you need one of Krynek's tack pushers.
Yes. Yeah, no, I agree, I do, but I don't normally do it this often, but it's just gotten ridiculous.
Well,
so.
I hate to say this, Gary, but I think you're getting a little, you know, retentive about it.
Probably. That would never happen with Gary.
Never, I'm sure.
So
I mean,
not
and I'm a fine one
there.
To talk, but I think you're taking the joy out of your stitching by being obsessed about something that can be fixed a lot easier once you're done stitching. It's not a big deal to have a canvas blocked. Most people do have to have their canvases blocked.
Yeah, I know, but it's a thing.
But, you know, Chadi Alderson always said, if it's not fun, it isn't needlepoint. And it is supposed to be a pleasurable activity. So I think you're being really hard on yourself.
Yeah, I won't argue with you, but tonight I actually stitched, so I'm back in business.
Oh, good. Thank God.
But I have to go get another canvas for the Diamond Delight because I actually absolutely ruined it. So, oh well, that's the way it is.
Did you have a lot done? Was a lot of it complete?
No. I had just gotten the center started, but the center's Jessica that's about the size of a dime out of Krynek. Surrounded by a Walnetto and then some Krynek crescents. And I struggled a bit with the Walnetto because I'd only done one previously. And so this was my second one. But then I have to say, when I got it done, I nailed it. So I was pretty happy with it. And then
once you figure those out,
yeah,
they're great.
Then last night I got to cut it, tear it out. So
I tend to get... I use the door frame, the door sill, to square up my stretcher bars before I put my canvas on it. So I make sure the stretcher bars are square. And then I just pull it really tight on all four sides. And I work, you know, put a couple tacks in the top, put a couple tacks in the bottom, then go to left, right, and just work my way around until I've worked out to the corners. And I don't really have a lot of problem with my canvases getting wonky.
Yeah, well, that's how I do it, and I, you know, it was out of square, just a hair. I mean, it's not bad, but I just got out of control here, so I have to calm myself down. And
yeah, I think you should.
But putting the metal things on, really good idea by Curdy to put.
So do you like screw those into your stretcher bars so they're okay?
Yeah,
but does it
just
ruin the bars? I mean, like, can you reuse them?
Reuse the bars?
Yeah,
sure, because you only put it on one side.
Okay.
Yeah, you just get, they're just right angle, flat pieces of right angle metal with two screw holes in them and screws. And so you just square up your stretcher bars, and then I just put two screws in each. And actually, on the smaller one, I only put it on two corners because you don't need four. And,
right.
And on the 17 inch, I put it on all four just because. But yeah, I just squared it up, laid them on there, marked it with a pencil, little pilot hole, and screwed them in. And it took me all of 5 minutes to do the whole thing. And, but now I know that that set is going to stay square no matter what happens. So,
yeah. But would you take it apart if you needed something that was 17 by 15?
No, I'd probably just get other stretcher bars anyway.
Okay. So,
no, no, that would just, no, I'll just get other stretcher bars.
Okay.
I've got a drawer full of them already. So, yeah, no, that doesn't.
I know.
Yeah.
We all joke around. We have enough to build a house.
Right. Yeah. So yeah,
like
no, I'm
any
way,
other hobby.
Yeah. I'm way beyond recycling those four sticks for something else. No, I just got more. So,
I've used them for kindling before when they get too many holes in them.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the little nightmare I've created for myself, but I think I'm through it now. I think I'll be all right.
I hope so.
A little therapy and I'll be okay. So, okay. So, a million questions for you. But first I want to hear about this cruise because, you know, there's every now and then you hear about needlepoint cruises. And
okay, we're not doing a cruise. We do a tour, a land tour.
Oh, I thought this was a cruise.
No, I think there are needlepoint cruises out there. But Jeremy Hamilton lives in right outside of London. And we decided that we wanted to try to figure out a way to get Londoners or Brits to be interested in needlepoint the way the Americans are and bring Americans over and show them some of the sites, the famous sites, and take them to some of the off the beaten trail places in the UK and do needlepoint the whole time. And it started because I went on a tour that was mostly about reproducing 16 and 1700 English bed linens, and I was bored. So, yeah.
Really to bored. Be honest, I was bored.
Yeah. So I, you know, Jeremy and I are friends, and I was talking, he was asking me about the tour, and I said, well, I got to see some interesting things, but you've seen one English bed linen from the 17th century, you've seen them all. I really wish that I had seen more, like what are people in the UK doing now? And he says, well, you know, people in the UK don't really do needlepoint like Americans do. So we thought, well, let's see if we can rub off on them and at the same time offer Americans a really nice taken care of, you know, pleasurable experience in the UK. So we pick them up at the airport, take them to their hotel. We have a meet and greet and we rent buses and we take them. We buy tickets to the places we want to go so that we get rushed right in. We go to the Royal School of Needlework, which has some fascinating classes and projects that they're working on. They showed us some of their work from the Game of Thrones costumes, and you know, it's just a really good experience. We take them, there's not very many needlepoint shops in the UK, but we take them to the ones they have, and their style of needlework is very different from ours, and Americans like it. So
okay,
I'm hoping that it'll turn into a cultural exchange.
And it's
so
interesting
how I thought they would be, I mean, they're like the masters of needlework over there. How are we different? What?
We use a lot more stitches, a lot more different kinds of threads. They tend to stick to tapestry wool and silk. And they're doing mostly tent stitch and basket weave.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And yeah, we throw everything in. They, they say that what we do is really not needlepoint, that it's embroidery. And we, I consider it needlepoint. We're on a canvas. We're on a needlepoint canvas. Embroidery is done on fabric.
But they're still, the only needlepoint is basket weave and tent stitch, huh?
Pretty much. That's what they consider to be needlepoint.
Hmm. How boring of them.
There's a few people out there. You know, I have a couple designers from the UK. I have Diane Grant, and she's doing things like Curdy Biggs and Debbie Rowley, where she's using more of the Jean Hilton stitches, Spolnettos. You know, she's trying to break out of the box in the UK, and she says that people don't really warm up to it very easily, that they don't know what it is. They think it's string art.
So she isn't careful, going to get herself kicked right across the ocean, huh?
Yeah, you know, I've met other people in the UK that know her, and they say, oh, she's not doing needlepoint. Like, well, then I guess I'm not either.
So this Royal School of Needlework, I've read several things about it. That's got to be one impressive operation, huh?
It is. It's in Hampton Court, which is a phenomenal thing to go see. And they have a couple, well, I don't even know how many square feet they have, but they spread out over a couple floors, and they have classrooms, and they fix old needlepoint. They help do some of the ball gowns and stuff like that. They did Kate Middleton's wedding dress. They're trying to preserve embroidery, not just needlepoint, but embroidery.
And so you got to see, because they have some real old tapestries there, don't they? Did you get to see much of that?
They do. Yeah, we have been very fortunate that we've been able to schedule a tour with Susan K. Williams, who is their director, and she pulls things out of their archives to show our groups. And some of it is, you know, embroidery, very elaborate embroidery, but there's a lot of tapestries. She takes us through what the students that are enrolled in their program are doing. So you get to see a little bit of black work, white work, gold work, ecclesiastical needlepoint, you know, everything. Some of it's old, some of it's very contemporary.
What fun. Have you ever done a class there?
Yeah, actually. I'm not enrolled in one of their programs because I can't go to the UK for a month at a time every summer and take classes. But when we have classes, we'll have one of their tutors teach. Like last year, they taught us a little gold work pomegranate, because pomegranates and peacocks were their theme for last year. This year, their theme is stump work. And so on our tour, they're going to be teaching a stump work reproduction of a brooch that they did for Queen Elizabeth.
Wow, what fun. What fun. plug your tour. You got one coming up here?
Yeah, we have one that goes from April 30th through May 10th. And some of the highlights are, we start off in right across the street. We stay from the Hampton Court in the Mitre Hotel. And then we travel to Charleston, which is the home of the Bloomsbury Group, which is Vanessa Bell, who is Virginia Woolf's sister. And her significant other had an artist colony in this old English sort of Tudor-like house, and the gardens are beautiful. We get to go through the house and see their artwork. They decorated their furniture. They decorated the woodwork, and they did a lot of needlepoint. And from there, we go to Eastbourne, which is a coastal town on the English Channel, and we teach a class there. That's usually where I get to teach. And we go to Woburn, among other places in between Eastbourne and Woburn. But Woburn is an old English abbey that is still run as an abbey, and the grounds are gorgeous. They have herds and herds of deer. I have never seen so many deer in my life. And the Dowager Duchess does needlework, and she invited us into her private home so that we could see a rug that she had done. And we bring in a lady there to teach us some classes. Her name is Rosemary Sherman, and she used to have a shop in Woburn, and she teaches us, you know, a little bit of everything. Last year we did some black work. We did a little bit of needlepoint. We did some beading.
Sold out?
No, I have places. I have room for people.
Come on, people. Sign up.
Yeah, come on, people.
Yeah, that sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, all meals are provided, all transportation, except for your airfare to the UK and home is included. You don't have to worry about a thing.
Ooh, if I had the time. Mm. Oh, that sounds like a great time. Wow.
We're trying to do it every year. We have a good time doing it. We might make money one day. We don't know.
No, that's just crazy. That's just crazy talk.
Yeah. I know. What am I thinking?
Oh, that sounds like a great time. Wow. Get some real history out of it and see some.
We call it quintessential England because we go into some of the historic needlework at Hampton Court, but then we go into some of the modern things that have gone on in the last, you know, 80 years up. So.
Yeah. Oh, what fun. So talk about the magazine. What have you done? Where are you headed with the thing? What kinds of things are you trying to accomplish editorially with the magazine to keep it at the forefront?
Well, we always are looking for ways to appeal to new stitchers, younger people, but at the same time, we have to be sensitive to our older subscribers that have been with us since the beginning. I mean, we still have subscribers that started taking the magazine in 1999. I try to keep the projects as varied as I can so that we have chart it, we have paint it. I try to find cartoons where they can transfer a line drawing onto their canvas and go from there. I try to educate people on different styles of needlework, what's new in the industry, new tools, new stitches, new threads. But at the same time, I try to enforce technique, because if your technique is good, as you know, because I know you're a perfectionist, you'll be happier with your
end result. Do you have a problem with that?
No, because I am exactly the same way. I can rip things out 5 or 6 times trying to make it perfect. So I want to keep this industry alive. That is my biggest goal. I try to support the designers and the distributors of all the tools and materials that we use by presenting them to our audience. And hopefully, you know, I make it a win-win for everybody, industry, stitcher,
yeah,
my staff.
And that's a big challenge. Keep this alive, which of course you'll never do single-handedly, but you can certainly play a major role in it with the magazine, because we do have, we need more younger people. I'm not one of the younger people, but we need more younger people getting involved. But,
right.
With all the threads that are available and the designs and the painted canvases that are available, I think there's like never before a real, a set of fibers and designs that can be appealing to just about anybody.
We've kind of been in a renaissance with needlepoint, with all the new things that we've made available.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's fun. I mean, just to go into a store and just look at all the threads there
In the hardware store yesterday looking for washers so that I could wrap them with thread and put them on my canvas so I could have a perfect circle.
no perfectionist here.
Yeah, you got to think outside of the box and come up with new ways of doing things and incorporating other items into your needlework.
Okay, I'm headed to the gun store here in the next couple of weeks to get one of those boxes for bullets to hold Krynex spools.
Yeah, those are great.
Yeah, because mine are in a drawer just rolling around, and it's just ridiculous. So,
and if you like doing beading on your canvas, those gun cases with the foam rubber in it make great beading boxes because you can just close them, and all your beads will stay where they are.
Ooh.
You open it up, and they're ready to go.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, now don't carry them on the airplane. They don't like seeing gun cases.
Yeah, they don't appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. There's a good one. Yep, bullet boxes and gun cases. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want a gun for that? No, I'm just going to bead with it.
I just want the case.
Yeah, you can keep the ammunition. It's fine.
Yeah. This one has a tear in the foam rubber. I don't want this one.
So one of the things when it comes to the magazine as an editor, I mean, you know how you pore over the words to make sure there's no typos, that the grammar's right and all those things. But you have this added dimension in that you're putting charts in there and you know, thread recommendations and all kinds of things. That adds an extra layer of proofreading and checking and testing. Describe what you have to go through that's beyond just what normal editors do.
Well, we have a process that's really long. People have asked me, can we have the magazine every month? No, it takes me 2 months to go through our process. I go to trade shows and seminars and I solicit designs for the magazine. And they come in to our office in every way you can imagine. Some of them are written on napkins. Some of them are hand-drawn. Some of them have so little type description. You know, they just give us charts and a list of threads. Some of them are very professionally done. And they're a dream to work with because they've answered all our questions. We don't have to call them or sit there with pins looking at the piece trying to figure out what they did. So my first step.
Oh, I feel for you. I really feel for you.
Oh. Vicki DeAngelis works for me and she is a manager of a well-known needlework shop also. So she can verify that the threads are what they say they were and that they're still available. That's one thing. From the time they stitch that piece to the time we run it, it could just be a couple months, but some of the threads will no longer be available. So Vicki does all that. Then she sends me the copy. She types everything in, gets everything keyed in, puts the verbiage in, sends me the copy. Meanwhile, we're doing the charts. We're sitting there with the magnifying glasses and the pins trying to figure out what the heck is going on and charting. And when Vicki gives me her copy, I send it to the first editor. And that person has a journalism background and has done a lot of proofreading, a lot of editing for, she's done a lot of medical journals and scientific editing. So she is really good with instruction too. So she's kind of Vicki's checker and she kind of gets the verbiage smoother. Then it comes to me and I do the layout. And I have finished the charting by then, and I have a graphic designer that works with me that helps me with the charting. And I put the layout together, and I send it out to 5 proofreaders. And they get about a week to go through it, and they give me all of their input, and I go through everybody. We do it through PDFs, and they put sticky notes on their PDFs. So I go through all the PDFs page by page. I start with the cover and open up, you know, proofreader number 1's edits and I make hers and go through all 5. Then I go to page 2 and I'm copy fitting as I do it. You know, if something's too long, I'm trying to cut a few words to make things fit or if something doesn't make sense to me, I'm trying to add words or add description to make it really clear. I have one proofreader that is a beginner stitcher, and she questions everything, which is amazing. And she's on my staff. So if Jamie doesn't understand it, then I know I have a problem and I have to fix it. So go through that, and then I send it out to
I have to interrupt you there, because that person is the most valuable person you have. I'm sure you know that.
Mm-hmm. I do know that.
Yeah, because when I worked on a magazine called Research and Development, which was cutting edge scientific research, scientists all over the world. And our managing editor, she knew nothing about science. And she performed that same function for us. I don't understand this. This doesn't make sense. And every time she was right. And so I know that person. That person's gold. Yes.
Yeah. Jamie, by trade, is our bookkeeper. But she's got that math mind. And she can look at the stitches and she can tell if something's off. And she's, you know, I always say when I retire, Jamie's taking over the magazine, because she's the only one that has the complete package of skills.
Uh-huh.
She can stitch. She understands the verbiage of the directions, and she can read charts. So, you know, Jamie goes through it. Two other people go through it. I make all of their edits. I usually get another person to proofread it. By the time I release the files to the printer, there's probably been 8 sets of eyes on all of the copy and the ads.
You can't do that every month, huh?
No. No, because even if I cut the number of pages, I still have to go through the process of getting it through.
Right.
That many people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It just takes
time.
And it
takes time to do it right.
Yep. Yep.
And I'm not saying that we're perfect, because I have never seen a perfect issue. I find the mistakes once the printed copies are delivered, and I'll open it up and I'll be like, oh God, there's a mistake.
Yeah. Well, I tell the story. My wife works with me on both the magazines I edit. And when she first started 10 years ago, Christine's heard this story. When she first started 10 years ago, she was on a mission. You know, we're going to have the perfect issue. And I said, Marga, I've been doing this thing forever. There will never be a perfect issue. There's always going to be a comma that should be there or shouldn't be. There's always going to be something. There will never be a perfect. And she just swore up and down she would be at the helm of putting out a perfect issue. And it took her a couple of years before she realized just not going to happen. It's just not. There's always something.
It's a good goal. And I do the same thing your wife does. I say, we're not going to have any mistakes. And most of the time our mistakes are so minor that I might be the only one that catches it.
Right. Mm. Right.
But I'm always going to strive for perfection. I'm always going to try to make the magazine better. And that's the great thing about the magazine business. You get a do-over every issue.
Yep. Yep. No, that's it. Yeah. I mean, you do. You have to strive for perfection. You can't ever give up on it. But to get there. But yeah, I once worked for a wise publisher, and I was really mad one time because there was an error that I should have caught. And he said exactly that. You know what? We're going to do another one next month. Just move on.
We learn from our mistakes, and we do get better and better all the time.
Yep.
Yeah. And, with my staff, we do not point out who made the mistake, because it's not constructive. And I tell them, I don't judge you on the mistakes you make. I judge you on how you correct the mistakes you make.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and that's with magazine publishing, to point out that someone made a mistake. Like you said, 8 sets of eyes. If they made a mistake and nobody else caught it, then it's on everybody.
Then 8 other people made the mistake too.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm with them because I'm looking at it too.
Exactly.
Yeah,
your name sits at the top of the masthead. Yeah.
There's, nobody gets blamed for anything on their own. It's a team effort to put this together, and we're all responsible.
Yep. That's very true. Yeah. So you travel everywhere. a lot.
I do travel a lot. But what? I have to get content for the magazine. I have to keep a pulse on what people want and what they don't like. I think it's important that people know me that and realize I'm just like them. I just happen to have the skill set that I can put this magazine together. I can't balance my checkbook, but I can put this magazine together.
So what are you seeing out there in terms of the hobby and where it's going, what people are interested in? Are there some trends that you're seeing these days?
Yeah, I think people are looking for other uses for needlepoint. They're getting back into doing upholstered pieces, wearable art. There's only so many pillows and framed pieces that a stitcher can do. I think that they are trying to find a useful purpose for their needlepoint. You know, knitting, when times are down, we're in a recession, knitting usually has a big splurge because people can justify spending the money for the yarn and the needles and the patterns because they're making a useful item. And I think needlepointers are thinking that way now too.
Yeah, that's interesting because as I watch all the posts and I have a feed of a whole ton of people who do blogs and you do see more of that. I would agree. A lot of ornaments. I'm always amazed at the women at Christmas time that take entire trees and fill them with ornaments. But nativity sets, three stand up nativity sets, and different things that people are doing. And yeah, because you're right. Only so many frame pieces on walls, and then that's got to be enough.
Yeah, I mean, you can only give your loved ones so many pieces of needlepoint before they start rebelling. They start hiding from you.
Yeah, because they know you're going to walk into their house and see if they're hanging up. Yes.
Yeah, I know. It's like my family has become like the zucchini. You know, oh, here comes Elizabeth, and she's got another piece of needlepoint framed for us. Where are we going to put this one?
Yep. Are you seeing, just an awful lot of effort and excitement and activity around painted canvases? Are you seeing that still going strong? Are you seeing charted work coming back? Or is it just kind of a mixture?
I think it's still a mixture. I do see where painted canvases have become more popular. And I have two theories why that's happening. One is, we don't have the stable of charted designers that we used to have. The other is that the painted canvases are fun and vibrant, and that's attracting our younger audience.
Hmm. Okay. And are stitch guides a big part of why that's working?
I do think so. I think there's more designers out there doing stitch guides. So, you know, there's the needlepointers that want to be told what hole to come out in and what hole to go down in and what thread and what needle. And then there's the ones that like to draw outside the lines and like the creativity of coming up with their own stitches and their own threads and putting washers on canvases that are wrapped with thread and, you know, whatever else they can come up with. But I think that you can only do so many geometrics, and you're going to start looking for other subject matter. And painted canvas, there's no limit as to what the subject matter is.
Yeah, and with the threads we have today, you can do so much. I've seen recently just a couple of them that I just want to meet with the person who stitched it. It just they take those canvases and they just put such life into them because they know exactly what to do with the threads and the stitches. And
we have so many talented people that are doing that. You know, Amy Bunger, Tony Manieri, Laura Taylor, Patricia Stone, Vicky DeAngelis. There's just so many out there that are able to put together a dynamic canvas.
Yeah, it's fun, and you see for a lot, it's, you know, how many times have I heard people say, well, I'm just about done with this and I'm really sad.
Yeah, it's losing a friend when you put it away.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to find another one or have six more that are in progress or just started or that you've ripped out three times already.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I don't even talk about how many works in progress I have. I don't know and I don't care because to me, it's not the end product. It's the process. And if I learn something on a piece and I don't want to finish it, I'm okay with that. It served its purpose.
I can't even imagine how tempted you must be month to month traveling
around. Oh, I spend a lot of money on needlepoint. And I pay full retail most of the time because I have to walk the walk.
Right,
you know,
right.
I teach the people to use your local needlepoint shops, and so I use mine.
Yep. Yep.
I'm not a reseller. The only time I buy wholesale is if I am selling it for the tour or something like that. Or occasionally I'll get a canvas designer that, because I'm putting it in the magazine, will give me the courtesy of selling it to me wholesale. But I really truly believe that people have to support their shops. They're starting to go away. People are retiring. The shop owners are retiring and they can't find anyone to take over for them.
Yeah, no, I'm a firm believer. I go out of my way to support my local shop just for that very reason. That's to have a good one in your area and be able to get to it without driving 4 or 5 hours is a real plus. And
nice.
You know, and you hear an increasing number of people who just simply have to say, I have to order online because I just don't have a shop near me. I can't get to one.
Yeah.
And,
which is sad.
Yeah.
Who is your local shop?
Welcome Stitchery in Crystal Lake is the one I go to. Yeah.
I haven't been there. I'll have to go check them out.
Yeah. Well, next year in town, let me know.
I will. I have one of my best friends lives in Chicago.
Oh. Yeah. Well, there you go. Because we have half dozen good shops in the area. I haven't been to just a couple of them, but.
Designer's Desk was one of my favorites, and Pat Delp was the owner, and she tried to sell her shop for years. She was ready to retire, couldn't find a buyer, and she's pulled her inventory into her home and is trying to liquidate.
Yeah, yeah, I guess she's going to try and continue with needlepoint in her home.
Yeah.
I've been in that shop. You talk
That's
about
amazing.
Inventory. Holy smokes.
I know. My friend and I joke around that we're pretty sure Jimmy Hoffa's in there somewhere.
Yeah, that was one house full of stuff, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. But and I always I stopped in one time. She was having a class in her classroom, and what a nice space that was with lots of windows and light. And
I got to take a number of classes there, and I'm really going to miss it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Yep. Welcome Stitchery is where I go. It's just 20 minutes up the road for me. So very convenient. Yeah. And a great shop. Custom framing a little bit. So that's where I go. Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a lot of shops? And you're out in Oregon, so you have a lot of shops out there?
We have quite a few. I'm right outside of Eugene, and we have one needlework shop in Eugene called Mindy's Needlepoint, and she's also a canvas designer. Good friend. I worked for her for 10 years because I just needed color therapy. I like just going to the shop and hanging out. And then the next shop that I go to is In Stitches in Portland. It's owned by a lady named Lynn Hart, and she has the same kind of taste I do, so it's always a big treat for me to go there and look at what she's got on her walls. There's another shop in Portland that's more of a cross-stitch shop, but they carry more of the overdye threads, and that's Acorns and Threads. We had two shops close within the last year and a half, 2 years, so that was kind of scary. I went into, like, full-fledged panic attack when that happened.
Yeah. What is it that you think, other than they just get old and retire and want to be done with it, what is it that makes shops successful? Is it classes, threads? What is it that you see as you travel around that
I don't
clearly?
Think it's one thing, because like Mindy is very successful, but she doesn't have classes. She doesn't even have a place for people to come and sit. But her canvases are gorgeous, and she focuses on trims and buttons and embellishments. Lynn in Portland at In Stitches, she has a classroom space, and people just go and hang out and stitch. She has a stitch night where all the local people can come. And I think that's what makes her a really successful shop. There's a couple shops that are going by appointment only because they can't afford to staff their shops anymore. So you make an appointment, you go in, you can get some help with your canvas and buy threads, or take a class. You could go there and take a class. I don't think there's any one answer, but I think to make it, you can't go into it as a hobby that, you know, you're just going to have a huge stash and you're going to call it a needlework shop. I think you have to have a business plan and a budget and be business savvy.
Yeah, that's true. Any hobby, anybody who tries to make their hobby into a business,
you better.
All right. So, Elizabeth, we're running out of time and I got 30 more questions, but we got to stop.
Okay.
So let's have a couple of recommendations from you. You got a favorite tool or technique that you've been using lately that stands out for you?
I have been using a bead buddy thing that is by Accoutrement Designs. It's in a metal business card case with a bead smith mat on it that your beads stick to. It's real portable. You can close it. Your beads don't fall out. A stitch that I've been having a lot of fun with lately is the Keenan stitch. You can work it horizontally, vertically, diagonally. It's a alternative to just basket weave.
Keenan?
Yeah, K-E-N-N-A-N, I think.
Huh.
Or it might be E-N.
Hmm. Where'd you find that?
My favorite. I found it in Stitches to Go.
All right.
By Beth Robertson and Suzanne Halloran.
So there you go. Get that book and then you have a new stitch.
That is my go-to book.
Stitches to Go.
Stitches to Go.
Okay. I've heard of it. So, yes.
Oh, you need a copy.
Okay.
Rainbow Gallery distributes it.
Okay. Then I'll hunt one down. I need a couple more books. So, yes.
Definitely.
So, and what's the... Your favorite thing, if I can ask that question, in the next issue of Needlepoint Now?
Oh, the next issue.
Other than your column.
My column is not my favorite thing. I'm breaking my own rule in that I'm highlighting the same designer two issues in a row.
Ooh.
And that designer is Pippin. And we have a canvas on the cover called Don't Let the Bed Bugs Bite.
Okay.
And it's got a lot of stump work techniques in it. And it's just fun. It's just a really fun, whimsical stitch.
Okay. Pippin?
Pippin.
Okay. All right. We'll look for that. And stump work. I wanted to ask you about stump work, but we're just out of time.
Well, maybe another time.
Another time.
Yes. Got to have you back.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, I sure appreciate it. And thanks to everybody for listening. And, of course, WeTalkFiber.com and... Available through several podcast things, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn. Several podcast services are now carrying us in addition to just simply listening to the podcast on at WeTalkFiber.com. And if you go to the website, sign up and get on the list, then you'll get notified by email every time we put up a new podcast. So, Elizabeth, we sure appreciate it, and enjoy the magazine, and good luck in the future with that, and we'll definitely have you back. I have more questions.
Okay, I look forward to it. You guys have a good evening.
Thanks.
Take care.